Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodrigues here. Thanks again for joining us. An estimated 5 million Americans suffer from Alzheimer's disease, an irreversible progressive brain disorder that slowly destroys memory and thinking skills. And as the baby boomer generation ages, that number is expected to almost triple by the year 2050, according to government-funded reports. Experts are warning of an upcoming Alzheimer's epidemic. At the moment, Alzheimer's is the only disease among the top six killers in the United States for which there is no prevention or cure. I misspoke in the earlier introduction to this hour, saying that there was no treatment. Indeed, there is treatment for Alzheimer's. We'll be talking about that during this hour of the show. We'll be talking about some of the latest in Alzheimer's treatment, research, and care. Joining me for part of the discussion today will be Dr. Kostas Liketsos, director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center. He'll be joining us in just a moment. But at the top, I want to start with a personal story about Alzheimer's, Kelly Lynn's story. Kelly Lynn is a retired nurse who lives here in Maryland. Her husband, Bob, had Alzheimer's disease. She's written a memoir about this called Our Long Goodbye. She chronicles the years that she spent as Bob's primary caretaker. It's a beautiful story of love and loss, and it captures what it's like to bear witness to the often heartbreaking effects of Alzheimer's disease. So, Kelly Lynn, welcome to Midday. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This is you write some beautiful things about your relationship with Bob, about your marriage. You were married 48 years. You say 48 years together, a long story, to see the same face across the table every day. In time, we could almost read each other's thoughts. Ours was a blessed union, no major problems, just ordinary people, ordinary lives. And then one day, I'd like to start the story at sort of the wake-up call, the real wake-up call about Bob's, the onset of Alzheimer's in Bob. 2004, and you were at a Walmart together. Would you tell us that story?
Okay, we had went to Walmart, and we separated to go our separate ways because he wanted to look at things, and he didn't particularly want to be tagging along with me. Well, sometime during the visit, I went looking for him, and I thought it was, you know, time to go home. I usually waited for him up front. He didn't come, but anyway, I was walking down the aisle looking for him, and he went past me. He was actually almost like he was running, and I reached out and touched him on the arm, and he somehow, like he wanted to get away, and there was a customer there, and he walked up to me and said, "You need some help." And I said, "I'm not sure, but I appreciate it if you'd stay." So we went ahead and led him out to the car. He never told me what was wrong. It was just that he seemed completely lost.
Mm. And how old was he at that time, Kelly?
He was about 70, 71.
And prior to that, you write in the book, there had been some signs. I'll just read another passage here. You say, "Once I noticed when I started to do the laundry that he had no pants or shirts in the wash. He had hung the dirty clothes back in the closet. So from then on, I checked the closet for dirty laundry. This was so unlike the person who always liked to be neat and clean. During this time, I suspected Alzheimer's, but the days and days when he appeared normal made me reluctant to criticize and investigate more deeply. No one wants to give up their source of strength and security." But after the incident in the Walmart, did you take Bob to the doctor?
We did, and they concluded that perhaps he had had a minor stroke. And that could be true, but even before that, his memory and things that had happened had got me thinking there may be a little more to it than that.
Mm-hmm. You were worried about Alzheimer's.
Yes, it was in the back of my mind, yes.
And did you ever use the word with Bob?
I didn't.
Yeah. He had a stroke in July of 2007. I'm sure that that made things even more complicated for you.
Yeah, well, he had taken treatment for a while. We had him to the doctor. Our family doctor recommended it. He went on Aricept for a while, but it did absolutely nothing. We had hope for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that maybe the medicine would work and at least keep it under control, and we would have a few more good years together. But it didn't happen. he had this major stroke on July 3rd, 2007, and that was the end of his cognitive abilities, pretty much.
And
he gained some control back, but not a lot.
Mm-hmm. Was he formally diagnosed with Alzheimer's?
Well, they don't always give you a definite diagnosis. I have heard, I know it might have advanced since then, but that the only way that they can diagnose Alzheimer's is after the death, they dissect your brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, there's some kind of abnormalities that are associated with Alzheimer's. They told us that it seemed to be Alzheimer's, the symptoms.
Did he recover any skills, even minor skills, Kelly?
He learned to walk. You see, his entire right side was paralyzed.
Mm-hmm.
And he had therapy. He learned to walk, not like he used to, but he could get around. He learned to feed himself. And he actually had to learn to swallow again. And he did that in the rehab place. They worked with him. It was wonderful. It was like he made a speedy recovery. And we thought, you know, that it was going to be okay. But he hit a plateau, and he never improved anymore. And then he had another stroke. And after that, he was put in a nursing home. And well, I don't know. He might have had several small ones in between. I'm not really sure. But he progressively deteriorated. And, of course, the last one, he died.
He died at 74, am I right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, Kelly, before he went into the nursing home, you had become his primary caregiver. You were a retired nurse.
Right.
Yeah. So you knew you were going to become Bob's caregiver at home.
And oh yes, it was understood.
I wonder. I understand why you wrote the book, I think, but for our listeners today, people tuning in, what is your message to them about your experience with Bob?
Well, I want them to know that their feelings are not unique. That all the major caregivers go through this. Especially when you're the main caregiver, and you feel very much alone. You're very alone. I was fortunate enough to have family and friends and neighbors that helped me a lot. And if you do have that, then for heaven's sakes, accept it. Let them help you. Because in turn, you are letting them be the Lord's disciple.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that you write in the book about some bizarre behavior that Bob exhibited as time went on, and that must have been difficult to deal with.
Well, Alzheimer's is tied in so much with the personality of a person. At first, you know, you see these people you know and have loved, and yet they're doing things that sometimes can be very irritating. It's really bothering you. And it just takes a while to accept the fact that something is wrong.
Mm. What was the worst time with Bob, or the worst time of day? Could you say during the long day when you were taking care of him, was there a particular time of day when it would be difficult?
Late in the day, and of course it got to be nighttime. He didn't sleep at all. His sleep was very erratic sometimes, and he could sleep half the day.
Mm-hmm.
In the mornings, he slept late.
And what would you say about this, about social behavior of other people around you, your friends and family, once they knew that you were caring for Bob at home, and Bob had Alzheimer's, it looked like he had Alzheimer's, and had these strokes? I'm just curious, what were your relationships like with other people?
Well, they were standing by. They wanted to help. People would offer to come by and stay with him while I went shopping and, you know, just for some time on my own.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out that they would tell me, you know, stay 2 or 3 hours, enjoy yourself. But I couldn't do that. I would jump and rush home. It seemed like I just felt that I always had to be there.
Right.
So they would send food or bring food. And even after he went to the nursing home, a lot of times when I came home during the day, there would be food left at my door. So, and it was a wonderful blessing.
It does. It sounds like you had a lot of support right until the end.
I did, but of course the main care was up to me, and some days I was there, well, 2 or 3 days maybe, that I didn't see anybody. They would call, and eventually people get on with their lives, especially after he went to the nursing home. And this is another mistake people make. They somehow think that once they're in the nursing home that your troubles are over. But that's not true. You still need them.
You still need the support of others.
The support.
Yeah. What would be the last takeaway, Kelly, from the book, Our Long Goodbye, that you want people to know if they consider reading this?
Just to understand how it is and put yourself in that place and start thinking about how you will handle it and what you want, what other people can do for you.
And accept the help.
Accept it, for heaven's sake.
Kelly Lynn is a retired nurse. She wrote the story about herself and her husband, Bob, who died of Alzheimer's disease, in Our Long Goodbye. That's her book. And Kelly, you live in Gambrills, is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, thank you for speaking with us today about this.
Sure. Thank you.
I'm going to take a little break on Midday right now. When we come back, we'll talk some more about Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's disease research with Dr. Kostas Lykketsos, director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center. And this is the Midday Show. Dan Roderick's here. With me in the studio now is Dr. Kostas Lykketsos, who has been doing research on Alzheimer's for several years. He is director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center. He's also chairman of the Department of Psychiatry at the Johns Hopkins Bayview Medical Center. It's nice to have you in the studio with us, Dr. Lykketsos.
It's a pleasure to be here. I thank you for having me.
What do you take away from Kelly Lynn's story? I'm sure a lot of that sounded familiar to you from other cases.
Well, I take away two things. First of all, a very dedicated wife and caregiver who devoted many years of her life to looking after her husband. And that's very common. We see it every day. And then the other thing is how the care needs that her husband had were really not being addressed, in the sense that we know how to address them, the behaviors, the sleep, the support of the caregiver. And yet there is not a widespread use of those kinds of know-hows and services. And so over time, she seems to have found some ways to get help from professionals. But that is a big part of the story for me that was lacking.
And is it true what she said about the diagnosis and what I have read, that the actual definitive diagnosis does not come until after death?
That is true, but it's worth taking a definitional break, if you would. A term you may have heard called dementia is really relevant here. Dementia relates to the memory and other symptoms that the person has. It's a clinical diagnosis. Person has memory trouble, other cognitive problems, can't function. And that means they have dementia after certain tests are done. Alzheimer's is what's in the brain causing the dementia most of the time. So to get dementia, you get brain damage from something. And it could be from Alzheimer's, it could be from strokes, it could be from lots of other things. So you can diagnose dementia very accurately, almost 100% in a living person. Whether or not they have Alzheimer's in the brain as the primary cause definitively requires a postmortem diagnosis. But in living people, you can presume with 90% accuracy in some cases that Alzheimer's is in their brain. You just confirm it later on.
Do we have now screening for Alzheimer's? Are there tests available to tell you whether you're at risk?
There are a number of tests available to tell you whether you're at risk, genetic and otherwise. Unfortunately, they're not terribly accurate. So there are some commercial genetic tests that you can do. I think it may be some of them are even over the counter. And they tell you whether you have a 2, 3, 4 or more fold risk of getting Alzheimer's. But to me, that's not very meaningful information. Anybody who plans to live to be over 85 has a 1 in 3 chance of getting it. That's much more meaningful information. And so let's say you do a test. It's not very accurate. What would you do differently nowadays that you shouldn't be doing anyway, which is lead a healthy lifestyle, look after yourself, and so forth?
Interesting. I read an article from the AARP Bulletin about what was described as a promising blood test for predicting Alzheimer's, I guess that's the word, telling you what risk you face. And the question, I guess they consider this the thorny question, is would you want to know if a test could be accurate? And I guess there's some question about whether the tests are accurate. But if it were accurate and you could know, would you want to know? To your point, what difference would it make? You need to live a certain lifestyle anyway in order to be as healthy as possible going into later years. But I guess it would might have a bearing on what you choose to focus on in terms of your exercise, for instance, or what you the various activities you choose to undertake. We've heard different things about ways to fend off Alzheimer's.
It could. So the real question is the individual that we're talking about. For some people, that kind of knowledge matters more than for other people. So if you're someone for whom that knowledge would really lead you to change your behavior, well, it might be more useful. Vast majority of people, including myself, probably wouldn't change their behavior too much if they knew their risk went from 5% to 7%, for example. Let's say a test could do that.
Kelly Lynn also, in my chat with her, referred to a medication called Aricept, A-R-I-C-E-P-T, I believe that's it?
That's right.
Can you tell us about that medication? She said her husband was prescribed this once the doctor suspected Alzheimer's.
Aricept is one of three similar FDA-approved medicines for Alzheimer's disease. Its main role is to, if you will, substitute for the loss of a brain chemical called acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a substance the brain makes that's important to the function of memory. As you develop Alzheimer's, you lose the production of acetylcholine. Aricept and its cousins, Namenda and Razadine, they block the breakdown of acetylcholine. So you've got more left, and therefore, in some people, it boosts your memory and functioning. Nevertheless, because you're continuing to lose the production sites of acetylcholine over time, the benefit goes away, which is why we call it symptomatic, as opposed to being a cure. It's usually a temporizing measure.
I corrected a statement I made at the opening of the show, Dr. Laiketsos. We're talking about the six major killers of Americans, Alzheimer's in there, no prevention, no cure. But when we get to the word treatment, actually there is treatment. You just described one, actually. So there is treatment for Alzheimer's. How would you generally describe treatment for Alzheimer's?
The treatment really is a package, and it has four types of elements. One part of the package relates to dealing with conditions that are comorbidities, high blood pressure, cholesterol, diabetes, which we know drive the disease to progress faster. So if you have Alzheimer's and your blood pressure is out of control, it'll go faster. Managing blood pressure, therefore, is one element, generalizes to the other conditions. The second is the management of the individual symptoms. So Kelly, for example, talked about trouble sleeping. Well, that's actually something we can manage quite effectively. You brought up the issue about social behaviors. Mm-hmm. Over time, almost everyone with Alzheimer's develops a problem in behavior. And most of the time, we're pretty effective at managing those. And then the other parts that that Ms. Lynn also alluded to relate to helping organize your life day to day, help the patient have activities, help the caregiver get breaks, et cetera. So that package that we call dementia care, memory care, much of it has been, if you will, refined at Johns Hopkins. We recently showed in a study can help people live at home longer for as long as 9 months, which, if you think about it, is a very substantial period of time.
I have a question that about the trends over the last 30, 40, 50 years. Was the prevalence of Alzheimer's at this level 50 years ago? Is this partly because Americans or people in general are living longer? Why do we see such prevalence now? 1 in 10 over the age of 65, I believe, is a statistic I saw. More than 5 million with Alzheimer's now, a number that's likely to grow as the baby boom generation ages.
Yeah, the answer is that at a given age, we don't think the prevalence has changed very much. What we have established pretty clearly is that prevalence grows with age. And so the more you have people living into their 70s, 80s, and 90s, because the prevalences are higher, you have more counts, more people with the condition. So the 5 million number in the U.S. is sort of what we generally believe is the current number, current living. If you think about it, and we're talking about that number tripling over the next 30 or 40 years, That means not that we have another 5 million people. It means that every 5 years we've got another 5 million people. And if you translate that on a worldwide basis, we go from 35 million, doubling every 20 years, to 70, to over 110 million. That adds up to probably close to 200 million new cases of Alzheimer's in the next 40 years, unless we get very effective. So the term I use is pandemic. Epidemic means you got it in one area. Pandemic means it's all over.
Dr. Kostas Lykitsos is our guest in this hour of midday, director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center. Those numbers are very scary, kind of staggering, actually, when you think about that, the multiplication there and the pressure that that would put on the care system, the treatment and care system. Olivia is calling from Owings Mills to talk about providing care, just as we spoke with Kelly Lynn about earlier. Olivia, you're on Midday. Welcome.
Hi. My mother was a healthcare activist all her life, and she was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2001. And she died 2 years ago, but she became an Alzheimer's advocate for forming a nonprofit, and she became pretty well known in the Alzheimer's community. And she was she went into a nursing home, I guess about 5 years ago, and I was the only family member in town, and so sort of all her care, other than the nursing home, you know, it was sort of all fell on me. But it was just, it was such an excruciating thing. And I just can't, for the families who go through it, it's, I mean, I was at a funeral this morning for my friend's father who had it and died. And it's just so hard. And it scares me to think of all the people who might, you know, in the future. And if I, you know, the genetic test, I don't know if I would want to know. So anyway, I just had the thought.
Thank you for calling. I'm sure you hear this a lot, Dr. Lykitsos, from the caregivers who bring patients to your clinic.
We do. And actually, I think Olivia raises another important point, which is the perspective of a wife is very different from the perspective of a daughter. And also because both the caregivers we talk to are women. In fact, that's the case for about 85 or 90% of all care is provided by women.
Where does Alzheimer's break down gender-wise?
That's a little bit controversial. The sense is that before the age of 80, it's about equal. But there's fairly good evidence that after that, women get it at somewhat twice the rate, potentially. And the other interesting thing is that once you get dementia from Alzheimer's, the condition for women seems to progress much faster. So you go to more severe stage or to death much faster than men do.
Hmm. What other studies, what do other studies reveal about who gets Alzheimer's, social class, for instance, race, or people with other conditions predisposed to Alzheimer's? Is there anything there?
Probably the strongest risk factor is genetic, and that comes in two flavors. There's a number of genes that are known that are, if you will, bad genes. If you get them, you'll get Alzheimer's. That accounts for maybe 5-10% of all the cases. 90%, the genetics are complicated and involve more than one gene, probably several for the same person, and in some cases, interacting with the environment. So genetics is one piece. The other, you asked about a racial variation. And in fact, there's probably a higher rate of occurrence in African Americans. And that might have to do, probably has to do with the fact that African Americans are more likely to have strokes, high blood pressure, diabetes, which are risk factors for getting Alzheimer's disease themselves.
Paulette in Laurel, we'll go to you next. Thanks for calling Midday.
Hi. I have a grandmother. We put her in a nursing home a year ago because it got to the point where she had no sense of smell and she was having a lot of cognitive issues. But currently, she has grown increasingly aggressive to the point where we can't even give her the medication. They gave her the patch, and what she'll do is she'll snatch it off and put it on the wall, and she'll yell at the nurses, and she'll actually yell at us. And say that there's nothing wrong with her. And the issue is a lot of the nurses were telling me that because she has no other issues, no other medical problems, there's no reason to give her any other medications like the other patients. So it's harder for them to try to convince her to take her medication. I'm not sure what our next steps are.
So, Paulette, you described something that's not uncommon. Now, I can't specifically comment on your grandmother, obviously, because she's never been my patient. But in general, there are lots of things that can be done to help someone with dementia or Alzheimer's who's being aggressive. The first step is to sort out the cause of the aggression. Many times, especially someone in a nursing home, it's because of something like a bladder infection, or maybe it's because they're not sleeping well at night and they're sleep deprived. In other instances, it might have to do with how the person is approached by the care staff. So if the aggression is happening only when they're being bathed, there's a challenge there with how the bathing
is happening. Excuse me. In the first two instances that you describe, it sounds like the reaction to pain is anger?
Right. So pain is often involved as well. So the point is, for managing aggression, got to sort out what's wrong and then come up with a plan to treat it. And what I advise get yourself a specialist who can help. Typically a geriatric psychiatrist. These are the people who really are good at managing this kind of problem. And there are a number of really good ones in this town.
Is that a growing field? It seems like it ought to be.
It ought to be, but in fact, it isn't. There are disincentives because of the way Medicare reimburses. So, in fact, our field has fewer and fewer people going into it.
We had Dr. Robert Gallo on the show a few months ago talking about research into HIV and AIDS and was bemoaning the lack of federal commitment to dollars for research in his field. And what about in Alzheimer's disease?
Similar problems. The figures that I quote is if you look at annual social cost estimates for Alzheimer's, it's right up there with heart disease and cancer. And yet, if you look at what the government through NIH is spending on research for these comparable social costs, in the case of Alzheimer's, it's 1/6 to 1/10. So if this is a disease that we want to take seriously, we want to fund it at
the same
level.
That's the ratio. You mean 1/6 to 1/10, the ratio of the cost versus...
No, I'm sorry. I'm not being clear.
Maybe you were. I just didn't get it.
Okay. So let's say that the federal government is spending $6 billion on heart disease. That might actually be close to the right number. Mm-hmm. The number for Alzheimer's is 1/10, which is about $600 million. So if they're comparable social costs, we're spending a lot less in R&D.
And is someone trying to do something about that, or is this just facing a recalcitrant Congress, which seems to be true in other fields of research?
Right. So I'm always hesitant to say take away a bit of the pie from heart and give it to Alzheimer's. Obviously, there is that issue here. But yes, there's an association called the Alzheimer's Association, which is a wonderful national organization that has a very strong advocacy arm and actually brings other organizations together to lobby Congress.
We'll take a break here and come back and take some calls for Dr. Lykitsos. Welcome back to Midday. Kostas Lykitsos, Dr. Lykitsos, directs the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center. With me here in Studio A, brain damage. I just have another clinical question for you. So we hear about concussions. We hear about NFL football players having brain damage and then later in life developing Alzheimer's, sometimes early onset, early before the age of 65, even before the age of 60 in some cases. So when we trace back, when researchers trace back the causes of Alzheimer's, do they find brain damage that traumatic, or is it brain damage on a much lower similar level?
So if you look at former NFL players, and I've treated some, I've had that privilege, they develop dementia with perhaps a higher rate than everybody else. It's not always due to Alzheimer's. There's another condition in the brain, or perhaps more than one, one of which is called a CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. That condition we don't understand very well. So in terms of the relationship between having head injury and repeated head injury and later developing either CTE or Alzheimer's, which really are both degenerative brain diseases, there are some links that have to do with a protein in the brain called tau, which is a mortar protein that holds nerve cells together. What those links are and how this is going to translate into therapeutics needs a whole lot more work.
Whereas with genetics, we understand a lot more about that because we can trace family histories. Is it as simple as that?
To some extent, what you really want to go is into the level of DNA. So really what's been happening the last few years are these very large studies, tens or hundreds of thousands of people, where the whole DNA strand is, if you will, interrogated. And probably 30 genes have emerged that have some small role. And then the question is, how do they add up and what is it that they do? So we're starting to get strong clues about etiology from these GWAS, genetic-wide association studies.
Dr. Lykesis, we'll take some more calls now from our listeners. Teresa, you're on Midday Next with Dr. Lykesis. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Okay, thanks. It's your turn, Teresa. Please speak up.
Oh, yes. I am concerned about myself. I'm 53. My grandmother had Alzheimer's and spent a few years at home with healthcare and then 4 or 5 years in a nursing home before she died at, I think, 87. And her son, my uncle, is now, they're not actually calling it Alzheimer's, but definitely in the throes of dementia. I have a terrible memory. I've never had a really great sharp memory my entire life, but I'm getting really nervous because I'm having issues, you know, with short-term and long-term, but mostly short-term things that are very alarming. And I'm wondering, you know, what I can do.
Well, I think you ought to consider talking to your daughter, to your doctor, Teresa. My experience in general with someone who's 53 who comes to see me very much in your setting, I have a family history, I'm starting to have symptoms. Vast majority of the time, the symptoms are caused by something else. So at 53, sleep problems, depression, medications, alcohol, those are stressful life. Those are the kinds of things that cause memory problems mostly at that age. And so talking to a doctor, perhaps getting a specialist assessment, which almost always is reassurance, those are the kinds of paths you might consider.
I hear concerns expressed sometimes in a kidding way, sometimes as a joke. People in their 50s or early 60s who can't remember something that anyone else would be forgiven for not remembering. It's hard to remember stuff. Some people struggle with that their whole lives. Others think, hey, I was very good at remembering almost everything, dates and times and places, but now I can't remember it all. I think we've become so conscious of Alzheimer's that it has affected people, made them very self-conscious about this, especially on memory, because memory is typically one of the first warning signs, right?
It is, yes, and there are other warning signs as well. But you're right. And we got to remember, Dan, that as you get older, there is a natural attrition to your memory. We lose, I don't know how many brain cells every day.
Right.
Just to introduce the term sometimers. That's what a lot of the 50-year-olds call it.
We'll go to Brad next in Baltimore for Dr. Lykesis. Hello, Brad.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Dr. Lykesis. Thank you for taking my call, and thank you for having this topic. My father was diagnosed with Alzheimer's in 2003, and he was about 62 years old, so very young. My mother cared for him at home for as long as she could, and in about 2010, he became violent. He became difficult for her to manage, and we had to put him in a nursing care facility. His decline followed very rapidly to a point now where he's in such a severe state, he can't move, he can't feed himself, he can't talk. We don't think he recognizes anything. And we went through a process of grieving for him years ago. And now we're in a kind of a very weird place where it sounds kind of awful to say, but we're kind of waiting for him to pass on. And we are hoping that that happens because he has no quality of life left. And we had an incident at the nursing facility this Thanksgiving past. He got sick. Got some kind of infection, and my mother really had to fight with the doctors who wanted him to go to the hospital, wanted him to be getting medication and hooked up to machines, and his living will say he doesn't want any of that. They were able to convince her to give him a shot of antibiotics, which ended up curing him, But now after the fact, we kind of realized that that was probably not what we wanted to do at school at that time. And she's called hospice, and so hospice has come in, and they will advocate for her the next time something like that happens. But it's just been a very strange place for me, my mother, and my brother to be in, to sort of just want his life to be over.
Yeah, it's this issue of end-of-life care and what you do is really huge. And I'm glad to hear that your mother and the family sort of felt like they didn't want the extraordinary means taken care of when your dad got sick. I wish more families were able to do that, and more of my colleagues were able to go there. But let me emphasize, this makes it even more important for people to give advance directives. If the person has specified someone who's going to make the calls for them when they're really sick, and in my case, it's my wonderful wife, then I think you can at least have a way to manage this situation so that you can go to the doctor and say, look, I'm the power of attorney for my husband. I knew him well. He would not have wanted hospital stay. He would not have wanted this injection of antibiotic. Let him go. I think that changes the context very nicely.
Let's go to Margaret in Baltimore. You're on Midday. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. I have a question, please. Presently, my mother is 81 years of age. She's in a nursing facility. She was diagnosed with vascular dementia and also a blood clot in her right upper leg, and she's on Puma. Can you give me some information on vascular dementia?
Of course. Vascular dementia generally refers to the brain damage that causes dementia because of the disease of the blood vessels of the brain. In the extreme, that's because the person has a lot of strokes, and each stroke takes out a part of the brain. In other cases, it's just chronic reduction of food to the brain that leads slowly to its death, if you will. That's vascular dementia, basically.
Okay. Virginia in Catonsville with a question for Dr. Lykitsos.
Yes. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question has to do with the relationship, if you know of any, between taking Synthroid and developing dementia.
I'm not aware of a relationship. If you're implying causation, I'm not aware of one.
What is Synthroid? But
I'm sorry. Synthroid is thyroid hormone replacement. Low thyroid actually can cause dementia. So if anything, Synthroid in the right setting can prevent dementia.
Low thyroid, low metabolism?
So if you don't make enough thyroid
of
hormone,
the hormone, okay.
Yeah, over time you develop something called myxedema dementia.
Now, that sounds like something that could be diagnosed if you were to have such a test.
Right? That's right, and I don't think I've ever seen a case, but we know from the past.
You haven't seen a case where someone actually had to test for it?
No, I'm sorry. I've not seen a case of someone who, due to low thyroid hormone, developed dementia. But we know in the past
it did.
That was the case, before there was replacement or before there was widespread testing.
This goes back to sort of where we started with our conversation, was why do you want to know? Why do you want to know if you're at risk? Why should you bother getting a diagnosis in the early stages if you're in their 50s or 60s? Because your answer seems to be, well, we know what you need to do to have a long life, or try to have a long life anyway. Absence disease is, you know, exercise and all those things that other doctors advise us about here on the show. And you're saying, whether you know or not, you still need to do all that.
That's
the upshot of it. Right?
Exactly. And in the case of low thyroid, it's going to be picked up at an early stage if you have a primary care doctor and you're going to them regularly. So you don't need to worry that you're going to get low thyroid dementia.
Okay, we'll take another call. Julie in Baltimore.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling because both of my grandmothers had Alzheimer's, and my aunt also had early onset Alzheimer's, and it seemed that all of them went downhill rapidly after the death of a close loved one. My grandfather died, and then my grandmother and my aunt lost a son. So I was wondering if there's some sort of correlation between Alzheimer's and a traumatic emotional event.
Yeah, that's a great question. There is evidence about this, and there are really two parts. One part is that a traumatic event such as the death of a spouse, the death of a loved one, can result in symptoms that were previously recognized to the person who died kind of showing up. So the common example is a patient is brought to me by her children because her husband died, and the husband was covering, if you will, for her symptoms. What I think you're talking about is stress in some way biologically impact on your getting this disease. That's probably true. There are some hints, for example, that stress through increasing the hormone cortisol over many years can damage susceptible parts of the brain and you can get dementia. Not terribly well established. The one example that I will give, which I think is very helpful for people to know, and that has to do with surgery and general anesthesia beyond a certain age. About 20% of the people we see first developed clear symptoms after an operation, a substantial operation. There's lots of work on what's the biology there, but the link seems to be very clear. So if someone is of a certain age and is about to have an operation, they want to make sure that they talk to their doctor and whoever is going to give them anesthesia so that they're educated at least about what the risks might be in relationship to different types of anesthesia.
What's the suspicion there? The suspicion is the anesthesia itself,
So the suspicion is that there might be some anesthetics that change the process of Alzheimer's, but the other is just the sheer biological stress. So Alzheimer's is living in your brain for a decade or two before you get symptoms. So if you happen now to have surgery, the stress itself might take it from an asymptomatic to a symptomatic state.
Dr. Lykessos, could you tell us about what you do at the Alzheimer's Treatment Center, Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center? I mean, the word treatment is in the title of where you work. But I wonder what goes on there in terms of your daily schedules. You're doing research at the same time you're treating people.
Right. And treatment, in fact, is in the name very intentionally. The treatment really consists of a thorough assessment. So we get the diagnosis right. Then working with our team of nurses, other physicians, we have physicians in neurology, geriatric medicine, as well as psychiatry working together, we come up with a long-term treatment plan. And that has to do with the four elements I talked about before, managing progression risk factors, managing symptoms, providing supportive care. Much of the time that's implemented through a primary care doctor or working with them. Much of the time that's implemented through us. People keep coming back and we continue to manage their condition in some cases over a decade or two.
And do you see patients improve at all? I mean, be careful how I ask this question because, I see the word irreversible associated with Alzheimer's disease, and everything we hear, the stories we hear, seem like a steady decline in conditions for people until they die. And do you see any sort of stabilizing of patients or even improvement?
Well, we see all of the above. So one of the things that we see are people who come in, they've been diagnosed with dementia, they've got a very severe depression that's untreated. We treat the depression and all, lo and behold, we're magicians. We have a lot of people who get better. But we also have folks who, in the context of dementia, are not getting adequate care. You might have a given level of Alzheimer's in your brain, but if you're not getting adequate care, you'll have more symptoms than if you have adequate care. So in those cases, yes, we see improvement. And we talked about some of the medicines earlier, and about 10 or 15% of the time when we use those in early disease, we get really nice improvements. They don't last for long. But one example I had was a gentleman who in early stages, I forget how old he was, a long time, he had given up most of his activities, including giving the paper that he would distribute to his neighbors on a daily basis. We put him on the medicine and he was able to do that for another 6 months. And so you get examples like that where people get better if you see them early.
Marie in Westminster, you're on Midday Next with Dr. Lykessos. Hi.
Hi. It's so nice to hear Dr. Kektis's voice. He got me through the 10 worst years of my life. And when Don was diagnosed with dementia and we started our visits to Copper Ridge, and then from Copper Ridge, I was teaching and I wanted to continue. I had to continue teaching. We went to daycare, which was good for about maybe 6-7 months. and then from there to Johns Hopkins Hospital, and then from there we had to put him in a nursing home where he did, after 10 years, pass away. But what I want to say is that you need somebody somewhere, and you're lucky if you get Dr. Kectus to help and guide you through those years, because they are the worst years of your life.
Thank you for the call, Marie. Dr. Lykitsos, we'll just move on to the next call.
I'll take
smiling.
The credit. Yeah, Marie, it's wonderful to hear your voice.
He certainly appreciates it. This is Aaron in Baltimore with an interesting question. Go right ahead, Aaron.
Yes, hello. I guess I'm on air.
Yeah, go ahead with your question, please.
Thank
We're
you
short,
for taking my call.
Time.
I have Asperger's syndrome. My father, I'm 36, my father in the 70s, both him and my grandmother on the same side of the family had dementia and Alzheimer's, and I was wondering, as far as people with Asperger's syndrome, if there's any correlation.
We don't know of one, Aaron, at this point. Asperger's, as you know, hasn't been known or described for a while, so the kind of research that's needed to sort that out hasn't happened yet.
Boy, it sounds like there's so much room for research here. There's so many questions about what's the cause, what could be the cure. I didn't even ask you about a cure. Is someone working on that?
There are a lot of people working on that with some very good clues. We're going to get something that changes the course of the illness, I hope, in the next decade. What's going to happen is we're going to turn this disease that kills you in 5 to 10 years to a disease that kills you in 10 to 15. So I'm not sure we'll reduce the number of people who have it, but hopefully we'll reduce the number of people who have it in its severe form.
I hear some hope in your message today.
I hope so. My message is, I'm glad you changed what you said at the beginning. There's no cure, but there clearly is treatment, and there's lots we can do to help people.
Dr. Kostas Lykitsos is director of the Johns Hopkins Memory and Alzheimer's Treatment Center over at Johns Hopkins, and we appreciate you being here today to help us through this. And sounds like we're going to be talking about this more in the future, so please come back to Midday. Folks have lots of questions, obviously, about this. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, and thank you.
And thank you, everybody, for tuning in. That's just the first hour of Midday. Another hour of Midday coming up after the news at 1 o'clock. Please stay tuned for the news, and then there's the second hour of Midday.